Accession number 29076, real 5.
And it would be controlling one or two satellites. And certainly, was it controlling us? I'm not sure. But it was certainly any airborne aircraft was in touch with sector headquarters. I think I've been probably misleading you as regards the airfield. I think it's almost certain that at West Hampton we probably didn't get an air-to-ground, ground control at all. I don't think we did. I mean, we had it air-to-air in between aircraft, but I think any talk would be with ground control. Yes. At sector headquarters.
Nigel Rose, real 5. What was the objective?
Well, sweeps had been going on for a little while before we arrived, and they went on for a long time after we, I left them. But the idea really was to go over and occupy the Luftwaffe, and with the Germans now moving a large proportion of their forces to Russia, Russian front, they obviously felt they had to keep us busy, and they. And I think we felt that the opportunity was arising now to make some dents in them. But I think I'm right in saying that probably strategically Bomber Command was more the carrying the war to the Germans from now on. The Fighter Command were more or less encouraged to sit up like an Aunt Sally over the other side and allow the Germans to expend their efforts on knocking us down, which wasn't very nice for us pilots, I must say. We used to go across mostly on bomber escort or rhubarbs, which was beating up ground stuff, ground targets. Or we just go across in a fighter sweep to draw up the enemy. These latter were the difficult things, because the Germans only had to check up on the radar warnings they were getting of us coming across the channel, and they could get up into the sun just nicely in time to come down amongst us. And we lost quite a few people that way. I had joined 54 Squadron at Hornchurch then, and we lost several people, including my CO about 3 days after I joined the squadron. He was shot down in that manner. The Germans, I think, had a fairly easy task. They could come down in quite a rush from behind and shoot at what they wanted to and pass on through and go on down. And so sometimes they were quite difficult to latch onto. And personally, I found it very unpleasant, and I hated the whole thing. It was a horrid feeling sitting there waiting for it to come. We escorted half a dozen bombers, perhaps Blenheims or three Stirlings or three Hamdens across to bomb some little power station or docks or something over on the other side, the Pas-de-Calais area. The deepest we went into was Lille, I think at about, 40 miles inland, I suppose, something like that. And on the way, one used to pass Saint-Omer, which was the German sort of headquarters of their Luftwaffe in that area, the Pas-de-Calais area. And that always used to cause some excitement, because they always had something up in the vicinity to have a go at us. So those operations went on for a little while, and I found in my a diary that my logbook, I was writing up quite a lot about each trip on those things. Some of them got too exciting for words, and partly because, you know, if you had been in a scrap and you'd followed somebody down, then coming back across the coast, there was an awful lot of artillery based on the coast to have a go at you as you crossed back. And if you're in bad weather, you had the first experience, at least I did, of finding yourself flying in a a very heavy mist with no direction at all except on your compass, and you went on and on over the sea, so to speak. It probably wasn't all that long, but perhaps 20 minutes it seemed long enough, with nothing in sight at all, and you wondered whether you were heading straight up the North Sea and would eventually sort of dive into it. It didn't show much faith in one's navigation, I'm afraid, but then that was the way with, in fighter squadrons, I think. So after I was a flight commander then, a flight commander in 54 squadron, and after a while that I thought probably my operational time had come to an end, I'd had enough of it really. So I asked them if they would give me a rest, and so I went off to 57 OTU, Operational Training Unit, at Harden near Chester.
Just before you go on to that, were there any, when you were doing the sweeps over Germany and escorting the bombers, were there any particular methods that were employed to avoid contact or minimise?
If you were escorting bombers, as you crossed the coast, you would see the bombers absolutely surrounded with little black splodges where they were firing at them anti-aircraft fire, you see. We were either close, medium, or high escort, or top escort to these bombers, but they didn't often shoot, it was my experience, they didn't often shoot amongst us, so they were mostly going for the bombers, I suppose, fairly naturally. Occasionally we got shot amongst them, not as much as we used to back during the Battle of Britain from going anywhere near Portsmouth, where they used to fire quite a lot at us from our own ships. I don't think we had any sort of special thing. We were meant to guard the close escort would look after the bombers, and we'd look after the close escort, and the high top escort would look after the medium, I suppose. So that's the way it was, really. But quite often, if there was an attack, then things used to get extraordinarily split up, and if aircraft flying all over the place, as I explained in previous days over Britain.
Was there a danger then that you'd lose the bombers?
Which did happen, yes. Sometimes one did. You shouldn't really, somebody should be still looking after them by the time they were well on their way home, I think, and I think quite often were. But if you came over in a sort of orderly fashion, I think quite often you went away in a disorderly fashion.
Was there difficulty in telling who was who in the heat of things?
Sorry?
Did you find difficulty in telling who was who in the heat of things? And
it did happen, yes. I'm ashamed to say I did certainly on more than one occasion. I fired a Spitfire. I think it was out of range. In fact, I know it was, because I looked at the sort of casualty list afterwards just in case I'd hit it. But as usual, I was out of range, and there were no reports of any Spits being damaged that day, so that was all right. But when things happen so suddenly and unexpectedly, you were apt to be a little, at least I used to find I was a little bit quick-fingered, on the gun button. And that's partly why I decided I'd had enough, I think, in those days. Yes.
Were there any instructions or orders issued for pilots flying over France in the event that they were shot down?
Oh, yes. I mean, you did get quite a bit of advice. You not only carried little buttons and things with compasses in them, but maps on little silk handkerchiefs and one or two packs which were especially full of bits and pieces, including a bit of chocolate and things like that, which you sort of tucked away with you in case you got shot down, make you last a day or two anyway before you found some contact. You see, if you were shot down on a sweep, there's a chance you'd get down amongst friends or not far from friends, and you might find somebody in the resistance who would put you onto a line where you might get home. I mean, a number of people did. Quite a few did, actually. I was up on that trip when... there's two things there. One, we were stationed at Hornchurch at the time. You've heard of Douglas Bader. Well, he was running the Tangmere wing. This is the middle of 1941, I suppose, about August. August or September, perhaps it was. Anyway, he was leading a Tango wing. When I was at Kenley. Anyway, either Kenley or Hornchurch, I'm not sure which. We were sent down to fly with his wing because the Scharnhorst and the Eisenauer were coming up channel. And they'd come out of Brest and were seen trying to get up through the channel. And so the RAF were putting up swordfish and torpedo aircraft, and they needed a lot of cover. The Tangmere wing was going to cover them, and we were going to go out with the Tangmere wing. And I must say, we were slightly apprehensive about all this because a German pocket battleship is not a thing to tangle with if you're an aircraft. Anyway, poor swordfish too. Anyway, when we got to Tangmere, like so many things that happened in service, it was all cancelled. Scharnhorst and Eisenauer had gone back into Brest, and the panic had died down. But Bader said, right, we've got all these aircraft here, we better go and do a sweep. So we were sent over the channel with him to do a sweep down the sort of Normandy coast there. And quite uneventful as far as I remember. And then we came back and went home. But the funny part was that about a fortnight later, Bader was shot down in the Pas-de-Calais area. And he managed to get out of his aircraft, but left one or both legs behind. You know, he was, had tin legs. I'm not sure whether one crashed with him and got bent, or whether he left it actually in the aircraft. But anyway, whatever that is, he was without his legs. And the German Luftwaffe began to get very sort of chivalrous about all this, and they got in touch with the Air Ministry and said, look, if you like, you can send some aircraft across, or an aircraft across, with a spare pair of legs for him, and drop him at Saint-Omer, and we'll promise not to attack you, see? And the Air Ministry apparently said, nonsense to that, balls. You can't do that sort of thing to us in the middle of a war. So they took his legs there were six Blenheims, I think, went over at the time to bomb something or the other, and one of them went over Saint-Omer and dropped some legs to him, and we were escorting them on that trip. So again, not very closely, but there we were above the legs when they were dropped. So that's another of the sort of exciting things in the war that happened. Now eventually I got this posting to the operational training unit at Harden, and I felt really I'd had enough of the operational side by then. I'd been in it for about 16 months, which was really quite enough, I think. And anyway, I did a lot of training work there, training other pilots to fly Spitfires, and did quite a lot of flying in de Havilland Masters. They were aircraft which had a curious arrangement where the instructor was hoisted up a little higher than the pilot under training, who was sitting in the front cockpit, and in the master who sat up just a little bit higher so we could see everything quite plainly. And we used to take them round first of all to show them the countryside, as it happened to us, and once we were sure that they would be reasonably safe, off they went on their solo Spitfire trips, and did quite a lot of formation flying and dogfighting and things that we could teach them. And eventually I became a squadron leader in charge of the air firing squadron there, where we taught these chaps to shoot air-to-air, air-to-ground, a bit of practice dive-bombing and rockets, and which had by then been developed, you see. And I went on doing that for quite a long time, and eventually got a posting out to Egypt, and there I was put in charge of the Middle East Central Gunnery School. Not of the whole school, of the single engine side of it, to do with Spitfires, chiefly Spitfires. And we received fighter pilots who were then halfway up Italy on the way, you know, the way we went up Italy, folded that up gradually. It took a long time to get up Italy. We got half a dozen every 6 weeks, I think, from squadrons in Italy, and gave them intensive air-to-air, air-to-ground, rockets and bombing. And we used to get occasional chaps from locals, the Saudi Arabians and the Egyptians, sort of sons of rulers and people, sheikhs and people thrown in. They weren't terribly good, actually, but when we gave the exam results, I don't know whether this was only my experience and nobody else's, but I know we used to try and slip an extra mark or two in for them because they were so awful compared with our chaps, anyway. I suppose it's an awfully racist thing to say, but we did that. Afterwards, I mentioned to several other people, and they said, "You shouldn't have done that. It's ridiculous. You know, you should have given them the marks they earned." Oh, well, anyway, whether we forwarded the work of the Foreign Office or not, I'm not sure.
What was the date of this by then?
Well, now into 1944. And a bit of 45 too. I'd had 2 or 3 years of all this, and I didn't really relish the idea of getting back onto operations, partly because I was married and had a daughter and all this, but partly I felt, you know, a year and a half of all that stuff was about enough. But many people, most people, did want to go back to squadrons. I think they rather resented the restrictions of being in a training outfit. It was on so free and easy as on a squadron, where, you know, you still had a lot of special, consideration, I suppose, in many ways. Although it was now, of course, mostly North Africa and Italy, where the action was taking place. Not much before D-Day in Europe for fighter squadrons, I think. Mostly they were doing dive bombing of, power stations and airfields and anything that looked as though it was preparing V-1 and V-2 sites. I think the squadrons were doing quite a lot of that then in 43 and 44. But my posting to Egypt coincided more or less with D-Day, and I found myself on the White Star, excellent White Star line of the Britannic, and she'd just come out of New York convoying and troop carrying, and we went out to Egypt from Liverpool carrying 5,000 people, I think, on the Britannic, and it was a mixture of Army, Navy and Air Force and WAFs, RACs and RENs, and my job as a squadron leader was to be security officer, and I wasn't very popular because at dusk, I used to have to go and turn the chaps and the girls out of the lifeboats where they'd secured themselves under tarpaulins, out of sight. And I had tried to get them in because the female officers in charge of these girls had very strict instructions to get them in by 8 o'clock or something like that, and chase up any defaulters. My other job as security officer was to run a small band of chaps deployed on censoring duties of letters written home on board, and we had to open up and look at every letter that was written, and some of these were in bland terms, you know, we're in the high seas and the weather's this and the weather's that and give my love to Auntie Beryl or something, you know, but some of them, and I can remember several of them, insisted on writing to a chum with whom they bared their hearts as to the night they'd had before they went on board. And believe me, some of them, whether they were shooting lines and exaggerating their prowess, but some of the excitement they got up to on the last nights had to be read to be believed. I think mostly it was exaggeration, but oh dear, it's terribly funny. That's another thing. It was 2 o'clock, was it? But it was quite amusing that I took part in some bridge outfit and stupidly got myself embroiled in a small school of bridge players, and I don't think I'd ever played contract bridge before. I'd been brought up on auction or something. I lost my paltry savings in one evening, I think, there, and I never went back to it. But there were some sharks on board. Otherwise, it was very nice because as it had just come out of New York before it came across to Liverpool and then took us, it had been victualled up or whatever they called it, you know, white bread, butter, bacon and eggs for breakfast. God knows, we'd never seen anything like this. And couldn't believe it, but there it was. And we had a fortnight to sort of going out into the Atlantic for about a day and a half, turning left, going down to, well, short of the equator, but then turning left again and going running straight into Gibraltar and the Med. If anyone could remember the sort of warm, soft seas and light and dolphins, sort of, you know, oh, wonderful. And then we landed at Port Said, where we were disembarked, and put on a train for Cairo to a transit camp. And a lot of WEFs and girls with us and hanging out of these windows in the hot atmosphere of Egypt. And there were all these chaps squatting on the side of the Sweetwater Canal, doing the most appalling ordinary duties of the day into the side of the canal. I think, and of course, the reeks of Egypt, you know, it wasn't really all fresh air at all, but quite an eye open to many of us. I hadn't been further than Switzerland before the war. Anyway, so eventually landed up at transit camp in Cairo, and then got collected and taken up to El Balah, Balah, B-A-L-L-A-H, which was a sandy airfield on the side of the Suez Canal. Taken out during the First World War, it was levelled off on a salt pan, which had drained off when the Suez Canal was built in 1872 or something like that. Or was it 82? I can't remember, somewhere around about then. When the Suez Canal was cut, this salt pan drained off and left a billiard table of an airfield. But the crust was only about 9 inches thick, or 10 inches thick or something, of sand, solid, consolidated sand. And that was fine during the First World War, when the heaviest thing was I suppose, a Vickers bomber, but a fairly light aircraft compared with, you know, the heavies of this last war. And but when things like Wellingtons began to land, there was trouble, because in the night the salt water seemed to ease its way up and the sand got softer, and the thing was on its belly in the morning. And the poor chap who'd booked the thing in at the control room and gone off to the mess for a good night's sleep came back in the morning and found the thing on its belly on the sand, which took a lot of putting right, because they had to dismantle the thing, of course. You couldn't put any heavy lifting equipment on the sand, because that too would have gone through. Eventually they scooped off about 5 inches, I think, of sand, put down chicken wire or light reinforcement and concrete, and from then on it was all right. Although it got a bit damp overnight, it stayed firm, and they could take reasonably heavy things on it. So I had a year and a half there, broken up with a visit back to England, when I could see Jenny for the first time, which was nice. I went on a gunnery course refresher at Catfoss in Lincolnshire. It lasted about 6 weeks. And we're now into March, April, D-Day. What am I talking about? D-Day was when I flew out there. VE Day, you know, when the Germans finally surrendered. And I landed at Lynham from Malta. That was Cairo, Malta, Lynham. Landed at Lynham on the night of March the 8th or May the 8th? May the 8th, wasn't it, I think? VE Day. And went up from Lynham to London by train and arrived in the middle of all the jollifications going on in Trafalgar Square. Extraordinary, from sand to that sort of thing all in one day. And from there I went down to Bognor, where I saw my wife and my daughter for the first time. She was then 8 months old, I think, or something like that, 8 or 9 months old.
What were your own feelings on the...
My feelings or her feelings?
Your feelings.
My feelings. Oh, it's wonderful.
Regarding VE Day.
It was wonderful. With regard to VE Day, well, I didn't know then, but when I flew back after 2 months on this course and so on, went back to Egypt to this job, almost immediately I got a posting to the Far East to, I think, join probably a fighter squadron out in Egypt, where would it have been? Burma or somewhere, I think. Because we were just beginning to roll the Japanese back then. I wasn't a bit pleased about that. I didn't think wanted to go back and fighting with zeros or something. Especially now as I was a family man. I didn't like the feeling of that at all. However, one has to go when you're posted. And so I got all prepared for that, and then, heaven thanks to the Americans and all the rest, the atom bomb was dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Not that it pleased them very much, but still. But it got my posting cancelled more or less straight away. And then I just hung on another couple of months and then came home via the Medlock route to be disbanded. But I wouldn't like to have gone out to Japan or east to the Far East at all.
What were the conditions like in Egypt?
It was a desert station, you see, this place that had been hacked out, or at least had been levelled off. And we lived in tents. They had concrete slab floors, concrete square blocks, just ahead in the garden, really, floors, and then just an ordinary circular tent. It was a big station. They had nearly 1,000 people, I think, in all. Terrific place. But it was quite a big training school, as these things go, and we trained bomber pilots in air-to-air gunnery and bombing, and they didn't do rockets, but our chaps did. But yes, including all the airmen, and quite a lot of them there. There were the best part of 1,000 people, I think. For recreation, there were a lot of hockey clubs that had been set up, mostly by the Indians, who had a lot of hospitals out there in the Middle East. And the Indians were terribly good at it. And they were playing hockey. Who played hockey? Well, the Indians used to like to keep the ball up about 3 feet above the ground most of the time. And, extremely dangerous to play with. And, of course, sand is pretty fast to play on. It was mostly sandy pitches. And if you can imagine a sort of sea beach type of hard sand, which it was, it was quite exciting. I became chairman of the Canal Zone Hockey Club or something for a short time, I think, before I left. I wasn't all that good at it, but I quite enjoyed it anyway. I did enjoy it. Yeah. But for recreation, there wasn't a lot to be done except drinking in the mess or going off to Cairo or Port Said, but little else really. We had a swimming place down on the canal, which was about 3 miles from the airfield, 2 or 3 miles from the airfield. And mind you, swimming in that canal, it was all the ships were discharging their bilges into the water, and you know, the things that are floating around really aren't worth thinking about. It was pretty awful at times. But the funny part was, I never heard of anybody catching anything from it, and so the salt must have been salty enough not to worry, I suppose.
Was there much contact with the locals?
With the populace? No, in the camp, most of the chaps were Italian prisoners of war, cooks and people doing the sort of, labouring jobs were mostly POWs. Very nice chaps, most of them. Typical Italian charm. And not the sort of people who want to get to war with anybody, I think, really. They really were very nice. I had an awfully nice batman called Giovanni, a delightful bloke. I never saw anything after the war, but he's the sort of chap one would like to have met in peacetime.
What was the ration situation like?
Well, not bad at all. In Egypt, they were pretty good. The Italians were very good at cooking steak and onions, and I think I had never had any in England since the war began, or that sort of thing. And you know, where they got the steak from, I don't know. Possibly from American sources. There were a lot of American stations there, and when the Americans started to move out of Egypt, because there wasn't really much, you know, we all went along the desert and then across into Italy and up into Italy. The Americans pulled right out of North Africa, I think, after that. And so there was no point in them staying in Egypt, I think. And they pulled out of their bases, and they were so luxuriously appointed that the RAF, who took them over, had to sort of break up all the nice things like cinemas and welfare rooms, and they took away, I think, most of their nice rations and drinks and things as well. the RAF said, "I'm sorry, chaps, but we can't have that because it's going to cause too many eruptions in the services if we stay on their sort of level their standard of living." What else? We had a rocket range there out in the desert. We had to sort of get into a jeep and go out there. And if you were deputed to go and look after the targets, and some of them were air to ground, where chaps just fired into a large square, and as their bullets were tipped, it was just a representative lot of bullets. You could count out how many they got, and so work out roughly how accurate their shooting was. But